I'd just like to introduce myself. Bruce Ulrich is my name, and I've been living in Christchurch most of my life, born in New Plymouth when my father worked on the railways, and we got transferred back to Christchurch, which was our hometown. Growing up here, went to primary school, Shirley Primary School, and Shirley Intermediate, then Christchurch Boys High School. From there, I had to decide what I was going to do, and I didn't seem to take to the sciences, so I went the commerce way and joined an accounting firm, 1957, just out of high school, and worked full-time there while I studied at night for the went down to the university for lectures and things like that, and finally got myself through and qualified, and the day I qualified I was admitted as a partner to the firm. Along the way I got involved in student politics, totally something I'd never contemplated, and I got into that through and that I played rugby at university and had a lot of engineering friends, not commerce friends. Most of my friends were engineering friends, and they said to me one day, look, there's a vacancy coming up for the position of treasurer of the Students Association, and being a commerce student, you get court for the secretary and treasurer and all those sorts of things. And so they thought they would like to nominate me, and they said, if you accept, we'll block vote you into the position of treasurer. So that's what happened. I suddenly became involved in student politics. Then I got married in the end of 1962, and our first child was a daughter, Jane. And we were having her christened one day in St. Barnabas Church one Sunday afternoon, and Jane was kicking up a noise, so I had to take her outside. And someone else who was there having their son christened was Ron Scott. And Ron had been involved in an unsuccessful bid to bring the 1970 Commonwealth Games to Christchurch. The previous ones had been in Jamaica. In those days, they were awarded at the previous Games. And he said, why don't you get involved in the bid? We're going to have another go, bring the Games to Christchurch in 1974. So I joined the promotional committee and resigned from all my other interests because I had to do a full day's work being a partner in the firm. And so 1968 I did that, and then after that I got nominated for the University Council. I was elected on the second attempt at standing and topped the poll, and this was 1970. So I was on the University Council at the age of late 20s, well, something like that. And but in the meantime, we were planning for a bid for the Commonwealth Games, and we found out that Melbourne was going to be our opponents. And we also found out that Melbourne were going straight to Edinburgh to pick up the vote, and of course they'd run the Olympics in 1956, and it was going to be a piece of cake getting the vote for the Games. So we had to devise a strategy. How do we outmaneuver Melbourne? And the first thing was we thought we would send a delegation of six to represent the bid, and we wanted to visit as many Commonwealth countries en route to Edinburgh as we could. So Ron and another fellow went through all the African Commonwealth countries. Harry Blaisey and another went through all the Asian Commonwealth countries, and another fellow, Murray Hunter, and I did the Pacific, went right through the Caribbean, Canada, the Isle of Man, and Northern Ireland. In fact, when we were in Northern Ireland, a hotel got blown up the night before, just across the road from where we were staying. Of course, it was in the Falls Road area, which was where the British troops were to quell the Irish Rebellion. So we all got to Edinburgh, but the big elephant in the room was we had the All Blacks in South Africa, and this was a no-no as far as Africans and other countries were concerned. But fortunately, the South African government gave honorary white status to some Maoris who had been selected for the first time in a Samoan. So we could argue that this was perhaps a step into a breakdown of apartheid, and that sort of helped us nullify the fact that they were over in Africa. So we got to Edinburgh about 2 weeks later, the three delegations of two, and assessed that we felt we'd, you know, with the lobbying, we'd had a film made for us by the National Film Unit, and we had lots of souvenirs and things we gave away. You must remember all this was done by letter in those days. I was the secretary, had to write all the letters, and we were going to do some promotional functions in Edinburgh because we were a promotional group until we had the vote for the Games, and then suddenly we had to become a study group and come back as experts on running Commonwealth Games a few weeks later. So we got to Edinburgh, and we had a suite in the North British Hotel, one of the big hotels in Edinburgh, and being the youngest, I got the short straw for having to be the host of the room because we had all this New Zealand beer wine we'd shipped up to Edinburgh has helped promote the Games, and we had, you know, different displays of New Zealand and Christchurch and things like that. And so being the youngest, I had to also be mine host for all the visiting delegates and media wanting a free drink. So I never got to bed for about a month before midnight. So anyhow, we had a luncheon where we shipped across a lot of food and beer from New Zealand. The person who travelled with me was the director of Air New Zealand, so we were able to get all this free transport. And so we'd got beer and wine and some foods from New Zealand sent across for a luncheon, which was hosted by a previous Governor General, Lord Ballantrae, and that was in the hotel in Edinburgh. We then worked out a menu, and we glamorised all the names of the food. There was trout from the North Internal Affairs hatcheries and some whitebait ship flying across by Air New Zealand. And I said to the chef, "Do you know how to cook whitebait?" And we used the whitebait fritters in here, and on the day they came out all cooked individually in batter. So we had these things. And then we shipped over some red and white wine from New Zealand, Corbin's Rivoli White. It was about the only one we had in New Zealand in those days. And the next thing, the hotel wanted to charge us corkage.
Oh, really?
And I said, "Fancy charging us corkage for pouring our wine, which brought all the way from New Zealand." Anyhow, we had to negotiate down a figure, and they quite gracious, and they said, "Oh, this is the finest white wine we've tasted out of Australia or New Zealand." Well, it was the only one we had at the time. So we had the successful luncheon, and then we had to plan for a party the night before voting. And we got a Māori group that was coming up to Edinburgh, and the National Brass Band was in Britain, and we got them to come up as well. And we sent a message back to New Zealand to send 150 dozen oysters via Air New Zealand up for the function. So we had the function. Normally in functions of that type, you issue about 450 invitations, with thinking about 200 might turn up. But I think we had the whole 450 there.
Amazing.
So that was sort of, that set the scene for the following day when the vote would be taken. And the critical thing was we then made our presentation. Mayor of Christchurch, a fellow Ron Guthrie, had come up just for that, to speak at the presentation, and we answered various questions, and we also got a few questions answered at the Australians, the fly problem in Melbourne and things like that, and asked if they're going to give everyone coming to the Games a cobra hat with corks around it just to keep the flies away. So anyhow, we then came to the vote for the Games, and then the president of Council for African Sport, a Nigerian, Abraham Odia, caucused all the Africans and said, "You are to vote for Australia. It's the way, because of the All Blacks in South Africa." But he found he had a bit of resistance. So he then said, "Okay, you've got to abstain from voting for New Zealand." So the vote doesn't go to Australia, but you abstain from voting. And he couldn't get unanimous support. So in the end, they all voted for New Zealand, and we won by 36 votes to 2. Melbourne managed to get England and Australia to vote for them. So that was quite an overwhelming victory.
Absolutely.
So the next day we became a study group and had to decide what we were going to, what part of the games we were going to study. And I said, I'll do all the organisational structure we will have for 74. And then there were no volunteers for the ceremonial, the opening. So I took on the opening and closing ceremony as well to organise. And basically when I looked at it, the Edinburgh, it was a very good model to follow, Edinburgh, because everything was done, mass bands, mass pipe bands, mass dancers, you name it, it was a mass, so everything, and I analysed the concept is that it needed colour, spectacle and emotion, and those were the three ingredients we had to capture in our opening ceremony in a New Zealand environment. Mm-hmm. So when we got back, you know, that was where I can tell you about a bit the opening ceremony a wee bit later. But anyhow, we became the study group, and then we coming back to New Zealand, and we had to take advantage of being the other side of the world. And so I went to Munich to see what they were doing for the 1972 Olympics. Wow. And got the idea of having a national competition for a Games logo, and got that from Munich. And Harry Blasey joined me, and we went to see Omega watches in Bienn in Switzerland. And basically, they had done the timing equipment for Edinburgh, but they wanted to charge us for it. And we thought we had enough to offer them by just being the doing the timing equipment. Games. Anyhow, we didn't tell them that we were going to go to Japan on the way back, talk to Seiko. And unfortunately, I was having acute toothache at the time, and I couldn't find an English-speaking dentist in Switzerland, and we're going to have a 24 hours in Vienna. Mm-hmm. So when I got to Vienna, the first thing I asked the hotel to find me was an English-speaking dentist. And I got to one, and he about to extract the wrong tooth. And I yelled out, and I think the right tooth was taken out, but I didn't want to have to go to a dentist in Moscow, which was our next stop on route to Japan. The rest of the day in Vienna, I went to bed to recover, and then we went on to Moscow, and then flew on to Tokyo, right across Russia, very long flight, and we met up with Seiko, and they were very pleased to do a deal, the timing equipment at no charge. So, going there was well worthwhile, but we tried to take advantage of being, like travelling to Edinburgh, we could take different routes, such as going through Africa, Asia and Caribbean and North America, etc. Mm. So we came back as so-called experts. And at that point, we then had to think about how we would go about organising the games, because at that stage we only had 3.5 years, because we got the games in July 1970 and we were staging our games in January 1974, so we had 3.5 years. So we didn't have much time. So we had to find a way of selecting the organising committee, and basically what New Zealand Olympic Commonwealth Games Association, who had been technically awarded the games, it was technically awarded to New Zealand, and it was Christchurch that was hosting them. They set up a committee to establish the organising committee, and they put the 6 delegates on the committee plus a couple of their own people, and then we basically tried to find the best person in Christchurch to run a particular thing like transport or accommodation, things like that. We approached that person, was not turned down by anyone. And they got their own little subcommittee going. So we then had the basis of the organising committee, which met, I think, for the first time just before Christmas. And I'd completed the term, getting organising in terms of reference, and we knew how we were going to structure it. And I found myself as a vice chairman of the organising committee. I'd gone from, because I was secretary of the promotion committee, but so I was... had quite a senior position, and I was also acting director of organisation before we made a full-time appointment, did that for about 18 months, and then on the side I was artistic director for the opening and closing ceremony. So I had, as well as having to do a day's work in the office, I did all these things en route.
I know, and you must remember that you had a full-time job at the same time, right?
So I had a young family, well, I had a wee daughter, and... Yeah. son arrived in 1971, so that was all par for the course in those days. So that was sort of where we got to a point of, you know, being ready to host the games. And then, do you want me to carry on?
Yeah, absolutely. It's wonderful.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, we then had to get serious about the venues we were going to have. We wanted to put down an all-weather track at Lancaster Park, Tartan Track, and the Victory Park Board, who controlled the park, bumbled around for over a year and couldn't make a decision. And, you know, we only had 3.5 years, as you well know. And so I went to see the mayor of Christchurch, Ron Guthrie, and the city were going to build a all-weather athletics track called the Mary Estate. And I suggested we combine forces and we would make a contribution towards the cost of that out of any profits we got from the games. And so that was, you know, that's what we decided we would do, because we couldn't make any progress with the Victory Park Board. And so we were going to go ahead and have the track and field stadium at the Mary Estate, which became known as Porritt Park, named after Lord Porritt, who'd been head of the Commonwealth Games Federation and an IOC member, and he'd won the bronze medal in the 100-metre dash in Paris in 1924, featured on the film Chariots of Fire. So that's what we were doing. Of course, we had a centennial pool in the middle of the city, which was being built for the Centennial Games, when Christchurch had missed out back in 1950 of hosting the Empire Games. They had their own Centennial Games, which I went to as a small boy. So we had that, and then we had to work out where we'd put the other sports and things like that. And anyhow, in the meantime, there was going to be a local body election in October 1971, only 2 years out from the Games. And Ron Guthrie, the mayor, had wanted to put a road through Hagley Park from Salisbury Street through to Harper Avenue, join it that way and close off the Carlton Mill Bridge. But he sort of put it bulldozers in Hagley Park without necessarily getting the support of his council. And one thing you don't do in Christchurch is you keep your hands off Hagley Park until there's general consensus and agreement. So this was a wonderful message that Pickering, the mayor heading the Labour Party and became mayor, was, and that on top of it he threw in a new stadium at QE2 Park as well as a swimming pool. And this happened 2 years out from the games. So we were wondering whether or not we would be able to even host the games, and we had to go to Munich. It was October 71 that occurred. 72 had to go to Munich and report on progress at the Commonwealth Games Federation meeting there. So Labour got elected, and to his credit, Pickering chose a very good engineer who had an architect reporting to him, one of the more interesting architects in the city, and they designed this stadium and were going to add a swimming pool to it, and that's what we had for the games. Far better facilities than we ever envisaged, but had our moments. And of course the stadium had to plan the design, appoint contractors, and it had to be done in 2 years. To their credit, they had it completed for the opening of the stadium in October 73. The athletes due to arrive in early January 74. And then all this time I was on the University Council, so we were having to build some new facilities for students and athletes to stage for the games. That was the Games Village for the. So that gives you a wee bit of the background leading up to the games, and then I'll get back to the opening ceremony if I can, because it was interesting the way that evolved. Firstly, we had to find a mass band comprising about 300 bandsmen, and not too many of those in New Zealand or Christchurch, but we had a good starting point in that the New Zealand Army had two bands in those days, one in Singapore and one in Burnham. So we decided to get them to bring the ceremonial committee. I was sort of monitoring its progress, but was headed by the local Army Brigadier and had people from armed forces doing all the detail, and they were very, very good. So band situation was partially overcome, and then I went to the National Brass Band of New Zealand, said, why don't you form up and join forces with the Army Band? So we have about a band of about 300 bandsmen really blow the socks off the crowd at the opening ceremony. And that's what we did. And then the other thing, we also had mass choirs, because Christchurch is renowned for its choirs in those days, and we lined several of the choirs to so we'd get a decent noise coming forth. And then we had the cultural section, and I went to Ngāi Tahu and said, look, I think as this is a New Zealand Games, all Māori tribes should be able to take part and represented in the opening ceremony. You know the answer I got? Not one North Island Māori is allowed into the South Island. So I turned it around and said, why don't you, all right, if that's the case, we need 400 Māoris in traditional costume for the display for the opening ceremony, about a 20-minute display. I was sort of monitoring the progress and went to the full dress rehearsal, which was 2 days out from the opening ceremony, and the Māori performance was an absolute disaster. Anyhow, apparently they came back on the rest day, and then on the day of the opening ceremony they were magnificent. But the other thing I wanted to do was to involve school children in the opening ceremony, and a couple of years earlier I'd been to Melbourne and Sydney watching a cricket test series between Australia and the West Indies. And I saw this rather strange movement. When someone scored 50 or 100, all these little kids jumped over the fence and ran into the middle of the stadium. And I thought that made quite a big impression on me. And I thought maybe we could do something similar with school children from Christchurch. So we've got 2,500. We have to think big for, you know, whatever we did with the opening ceremony. So we've got 2,500 school children to form the game's emblem, which the idea I'd got from Munich. That's what happened on the day. So the musical director, Professor John Ritchie, had arranged a special composition of boys and girls come out, jazzed up ones they could run or skip to, and that's what happened. So that was the cultural section of the opening ceremony, and then the rest of it, you know, it was just the marching of the teams, and also their closing ceremony came under our control as well, and that was, you know, you hope, you cross your fingers and hope it all happens according to plan, but it's the end of the games, the athletes relax, and so, but it was, you know, it was, the closing ceremony was disorganised chaos, but it was a great success.
I was just trying to imagine trying to wrangle 2,500 children to do the same thing
and red, white and blue capes, and you saw, may have seen the capes at the New Brighton Museum. So that's what we did. And do you know how much the opening ceremony cost us?
Oh, I'd hate to guess. $10,000
for all that. Okay. We did $20,000.
Oh, hey, that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, did pretty well. We're what we're able to do is to pass all the costs of the service personnel against the Army and Navy budget. We did a few side things like that. One of the first things I did when I got back from Edinburgh, I said to my colleagues, look, let's have a go at, see if we can get colour television for the games. So I went up, hopped on a plane, went up to, sponsored by NAC, National Airways Corporation those days, until they merged with Air New Zealand. And so we had some travel, so I could hop on a plane, go to Wellington, see the Minister of Broadcasting. And I suggested we try and bring forward colour television for the games. And that's what we did. We didn't have it. We had it for the major sports and the opening and closing ceremonies, but we were able to, you know, persuade them this was a good idea, and it was the first Commonwealth Games in colour.
Wow. And were we colour before the rest of the world or after?
No, it was after, but it was scheduled for New Zealand a bit later in the 1970s. Right. So we knew it was coming, but we thought we'd try and accelerate it so we could have it for the games. And we had it for the major sports. Some of the games were in black and white, but the colour, effect in colour was, you know, quite magnificent.
Mm.
So there were lots of things, and also got involved in speaking to community groups and Christchurch, and I think over the course, the lead up to the games, and speaking at some events outside of Christchurch, I did, gave about 200 speeches, group schools, you name it, but it was all a part of selling the story to the locals. And once we got the games, everyone got behind it and really, you know.
Definitely, no, I've heard stories of people whose parents went and bought the colour television.
Oh, of course,
bought the
of course,
fancy
yes.
television so oh, that they oh, could watch that in yeah. colour. Like,
yeah, it's, no, it's accelerated that, and people would have, there'd be colour television shops and be crowds standing us.
Oh, yeah, because they used to have the TVs in the window, didn't
yes,
they, playing things?
Yeah,
so.
they did, yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
A lot of people saw Dick Taylor's race. I'll touch on that one because one thing Edinburgh had done in 1970 is that they produced a gold medalist in the 10,000 metres on the first day of track and field. Ron Clark, a famous Australian distance runner, big fellow, was the world record holder, and he was in the race, so he was expected to win. And he didn't take into account a little Scotsman with white legs running behind him. And believe it or not, on the day the Scotsman that came to the run to the tape passed Ron Clark and won the gold medal for Edinburgh. And that really set the games off. And so one of the things we always wished for was that, in the hope that we might find a 10,000-metre gold medalist on the opening day of track and field. And sure enough, we did.
Sets the tone for the rest of it, doesn't it?
It did, and the games were a great success. Kept the cost of tickets quite low. Curitoo Park, we had a temporary wooden stand over the other side of the, which rocked a bit when people stood up. It was made by the City Council, built by the City Council staff, so... So we had about 35,000 people in the stadium then, and a lot of them on that temporary stand. But it really, people got behind. Once that day was over, people couldn't get to enough events. And so they were a successful games. Up until the day of the opening ceremony, we'd had our wettest and coldest January for 36 years. The day of the opening ceremony was a southerly, but it was fine. And the sun shone. We were blessed and had a beautiful hot weather without any rain for the next 2 weeks, basically. And at the end of the 2 weeks, we had floods in Christchurch.
Love that Christchurch weather, don't
we?
One
do.
Extreme to the other.
Yeah. So that's a wee bit about the games and the opening ceremony. A lot of individual things happened along the way to get there. As I said, we had to go to Munich in 72, and en route to Munich, we did the same tour, Pacific Caribbean, because a lot of the people in the Caribbean hadn't answered the invitation we'd sent to the secretary of the Olympic and Commonwealth Games Committee. In some cases, they were playing in jazz bands in the United States.
Oh.
So we took replica invitations over and were able to hand them out.
Oh, excellent.
And we also tried to get in places where we visited a copy of their national anthem, just in case they won a gold medal, and their flag. So I accumulated these as we were travelling on our way back up to Munich for the games. And so there were lots of little incidents like that. And certainly following the Germans was a big thing for me, particularly my grandparents came from Germany in the 1880s. But that was sort of the first German games since World War II. Mm. And so they did a magnificent job and very cooperative. Unfortunately, they were hit by that Munich massacre by the Palestinians, Black September movement. Where about 15 got killed. So we were close to all of that, but the games were, except for that, would have been a great success. But we learned a lot in a lot of detail, which I was able to bring out in the Christchurch games with giving people a bunch of flowers when they got their medal and a few things like that. So that was sort of
incredible.
The games. But if you want to do any questions and answers, I'm happy to.
Oh, I mean, I think I just love listening to the story of it. You tell the story so well. It's great.
Well, it was sort of a start for me. I really...
I mean, you're only a young fellow, weren't you?
Yeah, I was only in my 30s. So
yeah.
I'm the sole survivor of the inner group that ran those games.
Mm.
And because I was 20, 30 years younger. And But I had all this responsibility as well.
I was going to say, sounds like they welcomed you in with all the tasks.
Well, I think, you know, I brought a bit of professional, tried to bring a bit of professionalism to whatever was being done. I think that probably helped, and the way we structured things. And we had a little executive committee that met every Friday over lunch. It had some premises supplied by the Bank of New Zealand in Colombo Street, and we used to go there for lunch every, about half a dozen of us, for lunch every Friday. And if there were problems with aspects of the games, we'd get someone to come up and we'd try and solve them, rather than bogging down the organising committee at the monthly meeting. So everything at that meeting always went smoothly with the various reports we're getting.
Good.
We're monitoring progress as we went.
Yes, your experience, though, with on the university councils and
all those sort of things. I was having some very good commercial experience along the way, acting for people. And in fact, at the time, the end of the games, I've been a partner for 12 years, and the firm ultimately became KPMG. But I decided to retire at that stage. I wanted to, rather than accounting was purely more auditing and just accounting in those days, and I felt, I particularly after my experience of the games, I found I wanted to be more involved in mentoring and focusing on the big picture type issues. And so I set myself up as a business consultant at that point, and I picked up a few directorships. Oh, another story which you might like. One of the clients I had was friendly with Sir Edmund Hillary. After the games, I must focus on trying to get some more clients and building up my practice. And I had a ring from this client and said, he didn't even say who was coming to Christchurch, but he said, there's someone who wants to come and meet you. And they turned up at my office, and it was Sir Edmund Hillary. He wanted me to take charge, become chairman of the organising committee for 1975 Himalayan Expedition, which was to take place in October the following year. And I didn't think I could hardly say no.
Oh, well, no.
So I took it on. And again, it was a matter of, we had limited time, but Nepalese government had given permission to climb this particular mountain, a very difficult mountain, Mount Janu, October 1975, so we had to help raise all the money, and we did that by various means. And I was then going to go over to Nepal and walk out with the Sir Edmund Hillary from base camp with the climbers on the way back. Unfortunately, his wife and daughter got killed in a plane crash at the time, and he dropped me a line to say, look, he just didn't feel up to it. So I cancelled my arrangement. So that would have been quite nice to do that. So that was sort of something that I wasn't planning on doing, but we did it, and we got them there and back in one piece. We had to fly a couple of the climbers off with frostbite. And then during the games, gymnastics had been a demonstration sport, and the sports committee didn't want to have anything to do with them because only demonstration, much lower level. So I put them on one of my subcommittees and said, I'll keep an eye on gymnastics.
Yeah.
So when I went to my colleagues, they wouldn't make any funds available for the demonstration sport, which I thought was a bit lousy.
Yeah.
But I try and turn things around if I can. And what I suggested was that in the event of gymnastics making a profit, they would have no claim on it, would they?
So this is true, yeah.
So they had to agree. And guess what? We made a profit of $35,000 for gymnastics at the time. And they then decided to bring their national headquarters down to Christchurch and invited me to join the board. And a wee bit later, they invited me to be their delegate on the New Zealand Olympic Committee, which I took on. It was mainly a Wellington-based board, but I flew up to Wellington each month at my own expense to be a part of it. So one thing led to another sort of thing, and I was on the board for 20 years. And then 1982, one of the sports approached me to see if I'd be interested in being nominated as chef de mission of the term was general team manager then, of the New Zealand team to Brisbane. And we just had the Springbok tour in Christchurch in 81, or New Zealand, where the whole country was split right down the middle and riots and things like that. Mm. And the candidates for the position, nomination, I think three very senior sporting administrators nominated, a Knight of the Realm, future Vice Chancellor of Auckland and Oxford University. They're all candidates, plus me. I think I was the youngest, But I felt I would work with people, and you know, the 74 games gave me invaluable experience. I knew most of the delegates from Africa, Caribbean, and I think that's what swung the vote for my getting the position. Perhaps a safer pair of hands, mm-hmm. someone who knew all these people, and that's what. So that's what happened.
Well, with proven success as well. I mean,
and I really enjoyed that experience. I then was going to stand for a job for Los Angeles, but Ron Scott decided to put his name up by the back door, and I withdrew. I said if each of us were asked in the event of not being successful to get the chef de mission role, are you available as the assistant chef de mission? I said no.
I don't know that anybody wants to take a demotion straight away, do they? Like,
particularly when you read the accolades I had for doing the Brisbane job. So I stayed at home. I decided to make myself unavailable. And when it came next time around, the Olympic Committee changed the whole basis of selection. A certain candidate was able to get at the individual members of a subcommittee for his own advantage. You know, they wised that when it came to the next job, and which was Edinburgh 86, and there were two candidates, the chef de mission from LA and myself. Mm-hmm. Guess who got it on a unanimous vote? Exactly.
Old mate Bruce over here.
Yeah. Yeah. So then when it came to Seoul 88, no one was prepared to stand against me, so I got that as well. So. But I really enjoyed working with the athletes, and I always took a very professional stance and was quite innovative in the way I did things. I did a critical path plan of all the significant dates from the time of selection. I insisted on having a weekend seminar with all my sub-managers from all the different sports and that, so I could assess strengths and weaknesses of people and things like that. And I got people to come along, previous managers and chef de missions and things like that, to speak. And so that was always a part of, and I want to make pre-games visits. In the case of Brisbane, I only was appointed 3 months out. And previously, I think the practice had been the secretary of the Olympic Association, which gave them the team list as they hopped on a plane or boat to wherever they were going. So I obviously did things a lot more thoroughly, and I also... My basic philosophy managing team was I would create the environment for them to compete to their maximum as long as they were ambassadors for New Zealand and did their best. Yes. And that was the philosophy I basically had for all my teams, and it worked very well.
Oh, it's clearly a winning philosophy, isn't it?
Well, we had, in Brisbane, we also had the situation where women were not allowed to run further than 3,000 metres. They didn't think they were capable of doing that. And I was a bit against that. In Los Angeles, they had the first Olympic marathon for women. Of course, they proved they could run marathons. So I had a bit of a thing to elevate the status of women in any of the teams I was involved with. I was given a chaperone who's going to be in charge of the women members of the team. That wasn't what I expected to call her. So I'm elevated to the position of assistant manager woman.
Fantastic.
And part of the senior management group. And she was just, the three of us, and agreed on different things and how we would do it, etc. And we worked extremely well together. And it's a matter of having people who are compatible with each other. And when we got to Edinburgh, I noted that we'd never had a female flag bearer, either in Olympic or Commonwealth Games. So I was determined to appoint a female flag bearer and appointed Stephanie Foster, a rower, who won two gold medals at those games. And then when we got to Seoul, I realised that we only had three Olympic medals for women over our entire history.
Wow.
And I wanted to improve that. And that was Yvette Williams had won a gold at Helsinki in the long jump. Jean Stewart had won a bronze medal for swimming. And Maurice Chamberlain won a bronze medal in the 800 metres in Tokyo. She's still living in Christchurch. So it was a challenge to see how many women we could get across the line in Seoul. I felt we'd selected a pretty good team, fairly unheralded at the time. We started off early on with Mark Todd. Of course, he won a gold medal and the team won a bronze medal. And the team were two women. That was, that was the first strike.
Absolutely.
And we had women in rowing for the first time at the Olympics. Olympics. And they'd done quite well at the Commonwealth Games. And I always felt, given the right environment, we would do very well in rowing on the world scene. You know, and we had two of our women won a bronze medal in the rowing. So it's the first of our rowing medals in the Olympics.
Oh, and I don't even know how many rowing medals women have got now for New Zealand.
They surpassed the men. And I'm absolutely delighted with that.
Yeah.
So that was sort of the way I approached things. I never had favourites. I always tried to treat everyone exactly the same. Being chef de mission is quite demanding. I'd usually probably have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and every morning we'd have a meeting with all the team managers at 6:30, and I'd do it through all the teams I was managing, and that worked, so people knew exactly what was happening. Invariably, I'd have to go to a meeting of all the chef de missions, and then after that, I'd have a meeting of the New Zealand media. So this is a daily ritual, and trying to also orchestrate what was being said at these daily meetings. So, I'd take along a manager or an athlete who was due to compete, and things like that, to keep the media away from prying too much. Because in one case, we sent home a couple of athletes from one of the games I was at, and we had a major misconduct issue in Seoul, but we were able to keep this out of the media.
Oh, okay.
But so that's, you know, so you're basically, and I've always had a policy of, you know, being available to any athletes who wanted to speak with me or had any issues and things like that. And that was, I always had an open door policy. And in Edinburgh, I only had one bedroom. You know, that was my headquarters, the whole works, and I was even entertaining royalty in my bedroom.
Oh, wow, that's it. It's not the space you're in, it's the people that you're with, isn't it?
Of course it is, yeah. And they understand the circumstances. And
yeah, how amazing to open all those doors for all those
So one thing led to another. Here I was being humble. I was playing rugby at university, trying to get through a professional qualification, and I went on to finish a degree. One thing sort of leading to another, and that's been my life, pretty much.
Bruce, the accountant from Christchurch. How wonderful.
And, you know, at school I was always a very shy person, quite a shy person, although I did quite well. And I was in my last year I was a school monitor, prefect. I was in the first 15. I was captain of cricket, which was more of an administrative job, but that's really my first administrative job in sport, not realising what I was going to do subsequently. I was also an under-officer, and we had school cadets in those days, where the first week at school, we were practising to fire a gun and march and things like that. So I repeated that. I had to go into the army for 3 compulsory military training. As soon as I left school, I went for 3 months in there, and was the fittest I ever have been. And I came out of there and went joined up with commerce classes and at the university.
And then away you went. Amazing.
Yeah. So it's sort of things evolved for me over the years. And I was on the Olympic Committee for 20 odd years. Now, after the games, I thought I probably should upgrade my skill set in the commercial area. So I enrolled for an MBA at Massey University. I was still on the council at the University of Canterbury. This was 1991, so I've been on since 1970. I found out that Canterbury didn't offer an MBA, executive MBA. You had to do a full-time one, which I couldn't. I had to try and earn some money on the side. So Massey had a roadshow they bought to Christchurch and looking for establishing a cohort of students down here. And I think they attracted about 25. Students, and so they came down here, and we were to have lectures every second Saturday at the George Hotel. So I thought, well, I can probably handle that. So I resigned from the University of Canterbury Council, but I retained links because I was then became president of the Alumni Association in the mid 1990s, and I was chairman of a group planning for the 125th anniversary of the University of Canterbury. So that was still my links with the University of Canterbury was. So here I was being a student at Massey on the other side of the thing. Well, I got my MBA degree, and of course I had to have a games theme, the thesis we did. Guess what? I decided with a group of 3 other fellows, all with 100 years of experience, to look at making a bid for the Winter Olympics, using the South Island as our vehicle. And that's what I did for about the next 7 or 8 years on the side. And we got turned down at the final hurdle by someone called Murray McCully, the then Minister of Sport, who'd given $1 million to his own electorate to go for the World Cup of Golf, the golf club which no longer exists, turned us down for some seed funding to make a bid for the Winter Olympics. And we'd formed a special committee of very high-powered people. I went to Budapest to an IOC Congress in 1995 promoting it and got people eating out of my hand wanting to come to Christchurch. Then the following year, fortuitously, the New Zealand Ski Federation was hosting a World Ski Congress in Christchurch, and that was the Limes Room in the city the town hall. And all these delegates came out here, so that really gave us momentum. And I was wining and dining one of the vice presidents of the IOC and other delegates who run Winter Olympics, and they thought, what a fantastic location. Christchurch and Queenstown, we would have used the joint towns as a location for the Winter Olympics. And I had to fund all this virtually personally. No one wanted, the city council wouldn't give us any funding, and most of it was done by myself personally.
Wow.
We got two Task Force Green workers who had been doing promotional work for us, and they had done a deal with Trust Bank Canterbury to have a Visa card where we got a percentage of the profits.
Oh, yeah.
But in the meantime, Trust Bank were taken over by Westpac, who would not honour the agreement. And so I was left high and dry with quite a few bills I had to clear, including a bank overdraft.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's what the result of Cully turning us down with seed funding, because with Mike Moore, who'd been very keen on the Winter Olympics, he'd done his job, he'd been Prime Minister then briefly, he was Secretary General of the World Trade Organization, had a very good profile, was back in New Zealand. He and I turned the city council around. We had made a presentation to the New Zealand Olympic Committee, which I was no longer on, in support of the bid, and it was conditional on the city approving it and the New Zealand government. Anyhow, we got through, we made the presentation to the New Zealand Olympic Committee, and then we said to Mike Moore, look, you and I make the presentation individually to the city council. They had a special meeting of the council in mid-January 98, and we got that through by 2/3 majority.
Nice.
I was close to Jenny Shipley at the time, who was Prime Minister, and she was keen on the concept because Mount Hutt was in her electorate at the time. We wanted to do what we'd done with the city council to cabinet.
Mm.
And a few days before the end of January, Jenny rang me and said, look, cabinet's not meeting in January, and our deadline with the IOC was 31st of January. I'll send our Murray McCully to assess the bid. And believe it or not, if we had been successful, we had 49% of the international television contracts as our share of the income. And that was worth about $400 or $500 million.
I bet. Yeah. How can...
And he knew all this, and he turned us down because the Christchurch City Council would underwrite the games. Well, they'd never been asked to because we had this IOC thing.
Absolutely.
And didn't even have the courtesy to ring me till we had to read about it in the paper. That was the reason why he couldn't support it.
And for them not to see all that potential, it's just they're waiting for you.
Yeah, Harry had given $1 million to his own golf club, his own electorate, which for a second-rate golf event. So I was absolutely shattered at that point.
Oh,
and later in the year, I decided to go to China, see what China had to offer. See that big photograph, Red Dart?
Oh, yes.
That's what the Chinese government in Xinjiang built 11 months after I had arrived cold in China, not knowing one person.
Wow. See, that's it. For someone who is an introvert, you're a bit of a people person, aren't you?
Well, something like that.